Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Hacks is back for season 3, and so is the official Hacks podcast. In each episode, Hacks creators Lucia Aniello, Paul W. Downs, and Jen Statsky speak with cast and crew members to unpack the Emmy-winning comedy series.
You'll hear Hannah Einbinder and Jean Smart speak to their on-screen dynamic, along with stories from the show's writer's room, on-set antics, and creating the world that Deborah and Ava inhabit. Watch Hacks, streaming exclusively on Max, and listen to the official Hacks podcast on Max or wherever you get your podcasts.
Look out, it's only films to be buried with.
Hello and welcome to Films to be Buried With. My name is Brett Goldstein. I'm a comedian, an actor, a writer, a director, a legume, and I love films. As Abraham Lincoln once said, I'm a success today because I had a friend who believed in me and I didn't have the heart to let him down. It's sort of like how Sam G. Wiz, or whatever his name is, believed in Frodo or something or nothing. Yeah, I'm not an expert on Lord of the Rings, but that does sound about right, Abraham Lincoln. Didn't know you were a fan. Every week, I invite a special guest over. I tell them they've died. Then I get them to discuss their life through the films that meant the most to them. Previous guests include Barry Jenkins, Kevin Smith, Sharon Stone, and even Bed Brambles. But this week, it's the amazing comedian, podcaster, writer, and runner, Mr. Rob Deering. Head over to the Patreon at patreon.com/Brett Goldstein, where you get an extra 20 minutes of chat with Rob. We laugh a lot. We talk about beginnings and endings. We get deep. There's a secret. There's a video. There's no ads. You get the whole lot uncut, ad-free. Check it out over at patreon.com/Brett Goldstein. Ted Lasso Season 1 and 2 is available on Apple TV+. You can watch all of that in one go. Super Bob and Soulmates are on Amazon Prime in most countries. And the biggest of all, there are tickets, and they are selling fast for the big live Films to be Buried With live at the Hackney Empire on July 2nd. Make sure you get your tickets from plosive.co.uk and hackneyempire.co.uk. We'll have a right old laugh or a cry. Who knows? We'll see. You have to be there to see it. Do you know what I mean? So, Rob Deering is a brilliant comedian, musician, runner, podcaster, and writer. I met him when I first started stand-up. I had loads of gigs with him. I loved him then. I love him now. He's fucking brilliant. He now has, I think, 2 different podcasts. One where he runs and discusses music to run to, and one where he runs with the other excellent comedian, Paul Tonkinson. He's got books out. He's got it all going on, and he's so brilliant, and he's so lovely, and I really, really enjoyed getting to spend some time with him again. Hadn't seen him for a while. It was a real pleasure. I think you're going to like this one. So that is it for now. I very much hope you enjoy episode 196 of Films to be Buried With. Hello and welcome to Films to be Buried With. It is me, Brett Goldstein, and I'm joined today by a podcaster, a writer, a actor, a music quizzer, a musician, a runner, a book writer, and most of all, an extraordinary comic. Please welcome to the show. It's the wonderful, the beautiful, the glorious. He's only here. It's him himself. It's Mr. Rob Deering.
Hey.
Hi.
Oh, yeah, thanks. Yeah, I see how that works now. I feel comprehensively bigged up.
How are you, Rob Deering? Good to see you.
Yeah, great. My ego is huge. It's like a barrage balloon now.
Now, Rob Deering, I ain't seen you in a while. It is lovely to see you. But I was thinking of something. I don't know if you remember this, but you did a great act of kindness for me once, which to tell probably sounds quite weird. But I think it was like 14 years ago. It could have been 14 years ago. And I want to check this. I was working on a script that had kids in it, and my sister didn't have any kids, and my friends didn't have any kids. I didn't know any kids, and f- for some reason you and I were talking and I said to you, can I study your kids?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because I need to know what children are like. And I came round your house and we picked up your kids from school and we spent the day studying your children.
This is absolutely, yeah. The thing is, you were really worried that this was a weird thing to ask. And you know, because on paper, to your listeners right now, yeah, maybe it is. But I completely understood. And what's more, for better or worse, my kids are totally gregarious. They're the right kids for the job. And yeah, like you say, they were little. So I just thought, you know, it's like, you know, talk to Brett. And they're like, okay, off we go. La, 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 la. So I don't know how representative of kids they were, but it was right up the Deering family street. So you're welcome.
Well, in a way, your kids were so lovely and funny and nice that they were like movie kids that I was like, this doesn't seem realistic. These are like sitcom kids. I'm going to have to change this.
Well, I mean, I can't, you know, I agree. I think they're absolutely marvellous. And obviously, like most parents, I think they're the best ones. But yeah, they're not necessarily representative of their generation.
You also told me something, and I was thinking how I would word this so it didn't, I've figured out how to say it so that it doesn't out anyone. But you told me something that has stuck with me. And I think ever since I've asked parents about it, where we were talking, you know, nature versus nurture. And you said about your two kids and, you know, same parents, same loving home, same love in which they were brought into the world. And you said one of them, and I won't say which, was born with a certain personality trait. Again, I won't say what. And you said, and they were just born that way. And you were just like, oh, wow, that's their, they're going to be like this regardless of how we raise them.
Yeah, I think when it comes down to it, you're being too oblique. And I don't know what trait we're talking about, but I know exactly what you mean. Because again, in remembering when they were really little, and actually they were tiny at the time, but it was still late in the day that I cottoned on. My wife pointed out to me one day, quite close in age, my kids, they're like a year and a half apart. So when they were kind of 2 and 3 or 3 and 4, something like that, my wife said to me, of course, they like completely opposite things. They're completely opposite people. And I was like, of course they are. They're total opposites of each other. And I'd never got that before because they don't bump. They're excellent friends and they really get on. It's just that if you ask them about anything, you know, anything from, like, I don't know, popular music to Marvel DC to Marmite, they would have opposite opinions, you know, and that's just so nature, isn't it? They're, particularly as they get on and they're part of our family and everything, but they're opposites.
Do you think that they're more opposites because they're brother and sister, as in, do you think that their opinions are in direct relation to each other, as in, my brother likes Marmite, so I won't?
No, I don't think so. I think the opposite is true. I mean, neither of them particularly conform to any, in the wider scheme of things, neither of them conform to any particular gender stereotypes. And in terms of within the house, I think the fact that they're brother and sister gives them, and the fact that they're different, gives them a distance so that they get on. So they're kind of non-competitive as a result of their difference. So it's like the reverse of what you said.
I love that.
Also, what's weird is I feel like we're talking about them as these little tots, and they are the biggest, most grown-up children. And my daughter's about to be 16 and my son's 17. Also, he is like, here's me. He's like that. He's he's several inches taller than me and quite a lot wider. He's like he's strapping. It's impressive and kind of slightly scary. In fact, when I told him this morning about my difficult journey last night, he gave me a hug and I felt very looked after indeed. He was wearing a fluffy onesie and I was like, oh, thank you. You're my emotional support animal. So, you know, the hands on the other foot. And then, yeah, my daughter's slightly younger, but she could run the world starting tomorrow if you wanted her to.
So they didn't become scary, horrible teenagers?
No, they're great. They're teenagers, but they're great. And also, lockdown was amazing because we always got on as a family, but it was kind of good timing because I think we'd never really been together at the same time. So I think if we were all sick of each other, it could have been a bit of a flashpoint. But actually, because we'd never had sustained time together as kind of four grown-ups, we liked it. And then we got into it. And I tell you, we watched a lot of films.
I like this. It's a phrase you don't hear enough. Lockdown was amazing. right?
Yeah, that's right. No, it went well for us. I mean, obviously highs and lows. I think schooling was really tough for them. I think their school did really well and got better. But equally, yeah, we enjoyed our house. We enjoyed each other's company. I enjoyed the break from touring. And all those things, doing this, doing that. You know, me and my wife did yoga every day. I wrote a book. Right. It was a special time.
And you're a runner as a job now?
Yes. So as it turns out, you don't expect these things to happen, do you? And also, I'm really equivocal about it because people say people being boring about running is such a thing. And yet I am not safe from that. You know, I mean, I've got two podcasts about it. I've written a book about it. And if you look at my, you know, timelines on the socials, I'm like, oh, I see. Yeah, that's it. That's what I talk about. That's what I do. My only claim, my only hope is that I'm the runner who, you know, I'm not interested in talking about numbers or laps or interval sessions. I'm talking about what songs I listened to and what birds and flowers I saw and where I went and how much I reminded myself of people, Matt Damon in The Bourne Supremacy. So at least hopefully it's a daring angle on running.
I remember when you did your first marathon. I've forgotten this until just now. And you did it, you felt like dissatisfied with it. You were surprised how much like it didn't make you feel happy at the end of it, so you had to do it again. Do you remember that?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I didn't like it. I mean, I completely said never again and meant it, which apparently, again, I'm not the only person who ever did that. But I went off really fast. I went off like a rat out of a trap and then had this odd balance where I knew I could still get a good time if I just crawled the last however many miles. And I kept sort of stopping and going, and then just running on. And I couldn't handle the crowds. People say, oh, it's so great. You got all the crowds and all the support. And it's true. I mean, I think I've done a London Marathon like 8 times now, and I love it. I think it's fantastic. But that first time when I was all tired and feeling angry with myself, and everyone's going, go on, you can do it. And I was like, shut up, you don't know me.
You know my dad.
And I think also as comics, you know, one gets a bit more blasé about having an audience. I think your people doing a marathon are like, it's so great to have a crowd cheering me. It's like, I've had crowds cheering me. Go away. I'm better
dealing
now
with them like hecklers. What do you fucking say? I was just saying, go on, mate. I'm proud of you.
Oh, yeah.
When I come to where you're running a marathon and shout at you.
Yeah, yeah. And knock the trainers off your feet. So yeah, I said never again, and I'm now in a couple of weeks I'm running my 18th marathon, and I'm trying to get to 20 this year.
So you're gonna do 3 this year?
Yeah,
you're mad.
I don't know what happened to me.
Mad. That's very nice. Okay, one marathon question.
Hit me.
Do you plan a playlist for the marathon, or do you have no music? What do you do?
I'm very much into running, listening to music. It used to be always music, and then I get into running and talking, and that's how I got into, first of all, it started running with Paul Tonkinson and talking, and then that became a podcast where we run and talk, and then I realized that that's a good thing. So I've done quite a lot of running, chatting with strangers, because people who supported my book did that, and I met them, you know. But basically, my number one is running with music. So my playlist for a marathon, my playlist for running basically is an enormous, it's a huge playlist, but totally curated. So I always get a surprise, but it's always a song I wanted to hear. And these days, I've been trying quite hard to share that. So first of all, that's what my book's about, running tracks. It's runs listening to specific songs in specific places. And then I've been doing this other podcast, the Running Tracks Radio Hour, where I run and host a playlist. And honestly, you know, putting my own marketing feelings aside, I've done a few of those now, and those playlists are fantastic. I want the world to know. I mean, obviously, I would like them because I chose them, but they're quite eclectic. So I think everyone would find something. And it's reinvigorated. It's the second time my love of music has been reinvigorated by running. Because, you know, when I started running, mid to late 30s? I mean, I love music. Music is my life. But I wasn't really listening to much new music. And I was listening to like re-released CDs of albums I had when I was growing up in the car, you know. I got into running. I started finding new music. I just needed so many more songs. I just dug in. And when you dig in, you get better at listening to new stuff and diverse stuff. And then a second wave of that is when I started doing this radio show. Honestly, my own playlist from my making playlists for other people, that next time I do a marathon, I'll just be listening to Rob Doering's running tracks, because there's a thousand of them and they're superb.
Yeah. How many songs are in your marathon playlist?
It'll be in four figures. Hopefully, wow. Thousands, definitely 1,000+.
Wow.
I won't listen to all of them because that would take too long.
Then you'd be quite slow at the marathon.
Yeah.
You'd make quite a bad time if you'd finished the playlist.
I'd be like one of those people you see on the news that, like, you know, when someone did it on their knuckles for the gorillas, someone else did it dressed as a deep sea diver. And then it'd be like that, you know, so you come in on the news kind of 8 days later and I'm like, wow, what did you do? It's like, I just listened to my music, just taking just my
the
time.
The music was too good.
I stopped at a hotel. I slept, had a couple of nights sleep.
I really wanted to know what the next track was going to be.
Yeah.
Rob Doering, I've forgotten to tell you something.
What's that?
And I should have told you. I should have told you earlier, probably before we were talking about the running. But I feel like a dickhead. I'll just have to say it. You died.
Oh. Oh yeah. That is bad news.
Dead.
You're dead. Oh. Yeah.
Dead.
Okay.
How did you die?
Well, give me a minute. I didn't even know I had. Thinking back, yeah, I was... now I come to think of it, I think I know what happened. I was in a little...
Do tell.
I was in a small country village where I grew up. You know, it's one of those places, little church, little village shop, vicar, old lady, doctor.
You grew up in Sylvanian families?
Okay. No, it was humans. It was humans.
All right.
I think there was one hedgehog. And anyway, there was something sinister going on around the place. I wasn't really tuned into it. And then someone I knew and trusted came to see me. And I said, oh, hello. And I don't think, I'm kind of seeing it from my own point of view. So I don't even know who that was. But I definitely knew and trusted them and said something like, oh, hi, what are you doing here? And then I don't know whether they stabbed me or shot me, because I couldn't even see. I can just see my own face with this sudden look of shock. And that's it. What I'm saying is, I think I was the second murder in a little village murder mystery.
You were Midsummer murdered?
Yeah, if you want to know more about who it was and how it happened, you're going to have to talk to Bergerac or Miss Marple or someone, because it's too late for me. I'm in the back garden looking confused before the second advert.
You're the first guest I've had who's been Midsummer murdered.
I think, to be fair, I was Miss Marpled. It's you who's taken it to nettles.
You were Miss Marpled?
Yeah.
My God. That's
isn't incredible. It the dream? I feel quite happy about it, really. I feel like I'm part of a great heritage. I just wish I knew who it was.
You're definitely added to a list somewhere, and you'll get your own wiki page. You know, it is something. Do you worry about death?
No, I don't think I do. I worry about getting old. And there's a sliding scale, isn't there? Because I worry about... I'm aware of time, you know? I kind of think, oh, I must do that. If I really want to do that, I should really do it. Because I'm not immortal. Or like, oh, I did that. That was really good. I'll probably never do that again. You know, that's a kind of vague sense of mortality, isn't it? But no, I don't. I don't worry about it.
Well, it's about time you did.
No, too late, isn't it?
What do you think happens when you die?
Oh, I am pretty confident that we merge once again with the nothingness. You know what you can remember from before you were born?
Yeah.
Assuming you're not in the kind of Shirley MacLaine line of things. That kind of just nothing at all. That's what I'm expecting.
Well...
Sorry if that's a bit of a dark perspective.
No, I mean, it amazes me that you're like, you don't really, you're cool with it. I'm cool with just merging with the nothingness.
Well, you know, it's all good, isn't it?
Well, I've got news for you, actually, Rob Doering. You're completely incorrect.
I've got to tell you, the last thing you told me was pretty bad news, so I'm hoping this is good news.
This is good news, I think. There's a heaven. There's a heaven.
Hey! Oh, I called that completely wrong.
Yeah, and you're very welcome there. They're actually really big fans of yours. They love your work. They love the fact that you offer up your children as a scientific display. they love everything you do. They also love your playlist. They're like, we're just going to play this for the next millennia. It's filled with your favourite thing. What's your favourite thing?
Running. I just want to run and run and run. No, my favourite thing... What, you mean apart from films?
Yes, apart from films.
Because they literally are. That's the problem. I think nice places to run and films and, you know, somewhere... If, as long as in the evenings in heaven, I can have a beer whilst making a nice dinner and listen to some good music. Is that on the cards?
Do you know what? Your heaven's pretty fucking sweet. It's got long, long... beautiful nature runs. You got your bridges, you got your lakes, you got your seas.
I love it. I've got to tell you, I'm a big fan of Victorian engineering. They were all over the running. We got towpaths and disused railways with all the sleepers taken away.
Yeah, all that. That's all there.
Great. Brilliant.
Excellent. And there's screening rooms, and at the back of them, there's you could have your own beer and make your food or whatever it is that you do. And they're delighted to have you there, and they want to talk about your life, but they want to talk about your life through film. The first thing they ask you is, what is the first film you remember seeing, Rob Deering?
I'm sure it's not the first film, but it was so iconic that I definitely remember going, was Star Wars. And that's why to this day I always refer to it as Star Wars as opposed to, you know, A New Hope or anything like that. But I'm talking about Star Wars Episode 4, A New Hope. And I saw that at the cinema. And I think I would have been 5.
Wow.
So that was quite full on. And because I do remember seeing those. You know those steaming corpses? The ones that have had all the flesh burnt off their body?
Oh, yeah.
Uncle Owen and Aunt Beru. Sure. I totally remember them. So that does suggest that it was a bit scarring. Because I was like, oh, that's what a flamethrower's corpse would look like. And says Deering, age 5. But I loved it. You know, I love Star Wars. And it's funny enough, I remember showing Star Wars to my kids when they were about 5, or one of them was. And I was like, wow, this has got loads of guns and explosions in it. I have regrets. But forget all that, because I don't think that's the first film I saw at the cinema. It was just like a really early experience. Like, I really remember, you know, obviously I'm the generation, I'm sure everyone else is, but a similar shock thing. I remember being at the cinema and we were queuing, you know, like you used to, I don't think you get this anymore. We were queuing by a little gold sign in a corridor with like red carpet. So it might as well have been the 30s, but it wasn't. It was about 1980. And we were waiting to get in. We were all very excited to go and see the big new film. And the audience before came out. And like, I was trying not to listen. Don't want to be plot spoilers. And there was loads of little boys my age coming in the opposite direction. And they were all going, oh, his face! The face is melting! It's melting! Oh, did we see his face? They were melting! Ah! And they were really excited about it, loved it. But I would also say with a sprinkle of traumatized. It had been a bit much for them. What film was I waiting to get into?
Raiders of the Lost Ark.
I remember that very clearly, and I was a bit scared, frankly. It is quite a lot, isn't it, that last scene? But no, sorry, none of that. Before either of those films, victory before Raiders.
Can you please answer the question?
Answer the question! Sinbad and the Eye of the Tiger. That's the first film I remember seeing at the cinema, and I loved it.
Wow. That is cool.
Because people don't talk about those films because they're so rubbish now, but they were great at the time. It wasn't the same era, wasn't it? Because there were the real high watermark for those kind of films is like Jason and the Argonauts.
Yeah.
And that was great as well, but that would see that on the telly. But they were still making them, the kind of Harryhausen, stop motion stuff, Greek myths. Sinbad and the Eye of the Tiger, I remember being really exciting. And then another one, like Clash of the Titans with Harry Hamlin and the little robot owl. Burgess Meredith in it. Love those.
That's right.
And Sinbad and the Eye, we went to see Spider-Man and we couldn't get in. So we went to see Sinbad and the Eye of the Tiger and I was really disappointed. And I don't know if you remember what version of Spider-Man that is, but it's not in the canon, put it that way.
It's the one with the sort of TV movie version.
Yeah, that they released.
Quite a loose fitting suit he's wearing.
Yeah, and T-strainers for eyes.
Yeah. It's like, sort of like pyjamas and he keeps having to pull them up as he climbs.
That's right, with Tobey Maguire. No. So yeah, we couldn't get into that and we went to see Sinbad and the Eye of the Tiger.
Who do you go with? I forgot, have you got a brother?
My big brother is a few years older than me. Yeah, he would have been there then because I was really little, but he's like 6 years older. So when I was a bit older, he wouldn't necessarily be there. He'd be off teenaging.
Right.
But he'd been there then because I'd about 4 and 10. Yeah.
All right. Okay. Lovely. What is the film that scared you the most? Do you like being scared?
I don't really. I've avoided that line of country. I mean, I've experienced it. You know what I mean? My particular take on a scary film is if it's iconic, you know, if it's in the canon, a film we ought to have seen, then I want to see it so that I've seen it. But I wouldn't seek it out for the thrill. So I've seen The Blair Witch Project, but I didn't enjoy it. No, I mean, I did enjoy it. It wasn't, it was kind of before everyone was like, yeah. But anyway, so I think probably, oh, it's a difficult one. One of the scariest films I've ever seen was the original, I don't know if this counts, TV movie version of The Woman in Black.
Oh, right. With Andy Nyman.
Yeah, and it was not, they lost it for ages, didn't they? No one had the rights, and it's recently been found again.
Released,
and it's difficult. The trouble is it's slightly harder to see exactly how scary it is if you see The Woman in Black as Miss Lemon from Poirot on ITV. That undermines it. But honestly, that really shook me up. But I watched that on TV, so I don't think it counts. Oh, again, generationally, I am that generation who couldn't go anywhere near any water, including the upstairs toilet, after Jaws was on TV. I think it was one particular Saturday night in about 81.
Wow.
But the scariest film, actually, I want myself in the cinema to answer this properly. So we jump forward a few years. I did a gig at Nottingham Jonglers, and it was a horrible audience and bad sound. And I'm not going to lie to you, Brett, it didn't go well for me. There was booing and they threw things. I mean, it was like that. It was like a fictional comedy death. God. And then I drank a lot of gin. And then I went to a pub and I drank a lot more gin. And then I went and saw The Orphanage.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
That's a fucking great film.
It's absolutely fantastic. And the thing is, it's the emotion of it. It was terrifying. I mean, particularly for me, I don't really watch scary films, as has been established. And it's so scary, but it's also so sad.
So sad.
Oh, God. It just broke me. I couldn't think about it. Couldn't think about the end of it for months. But from here, it was like the timing of it was amazing. It was like the worst night of my life, but I drew the sting of the whole thing with this incredible film. I mean, really great, but awful. Just awful.
Yeah, awful. It's awful. What's the Nottingham Jonglers? What is the film that made you cry the most? Are you a crier? I imagine you're a crier.
I'm a massive crier. The speech Jude Law gives in The Holiday. I'm a weeper. I weep at greetings cards. That's me. That's based on me. He was quoting me directly. but no, the funny thing is, though, and it's obviously connected, is I wasn't. I thought I was. It's all to do with emotional repression originally. I remember going to, here we are. I'd like to apologize. Hey, you can cut me wherever you like, but I'm going to continually tell you about films that aren't the answer to your question. Because
this
I went.
Be the longest podcast.
Yeah, particularly as I'm in a generation where we're going through a barrier that is all the films ever, you know, sort of between sort of 77 to 84. Lived it, mate. But so me and Richard Osborne and Richard Osborne's mum went to see E.T. And he was on my left and she was on my right. And for the last half hour of the film, I was passing tissues. Can I have a tissue? Can I have a tissue? And I didn't cry. I mean, I watched E.T. and not only did I not cry.
You're a psychopath.
I know. I didn't understand why you would. You know what I mean? And I've seen it in recent years. And I've been as messed up as, I mean, and I'm a terrible crier. When me and my wife came out of Titanic, we started the car. And then stopped it again and just sat crying like for ages. Like, I can't drive while this is happening. And I went to see, English Patient with my friend of mine in Finland. And she was just chatting away about doing the post-film debrief. And I just said, I want you to stop talking about it. Anyway, the thing that where it broke was, it was One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Oh, wow.
I saw it on TV when I was, I don't know when it was, but it wouldn't have been that long after I'd seen E.T. and in Psychopath style. And I remember watching One for the... Yeah, like, no soul. Not even understanding. What is on the alien
so
has? The
so
alien
what?
Got
what
they wanted. it was, you know, logistically, the scheme is complete.
He phoned home, he went home, the end.
He phoned home, went home. What's your beef? So, you know, and they had a lovely bike ride, for goodness sake. And the funny thing is, I remember that. I remember just when the floodgates went, I didn't know what to do. I mean, it hurt in my soul. And I went and had a bath. I was all upset. And my mum it probably thought, we traumatized him, we don't know what to do. She said, why don't you have a bath? And I went and had a bath, and I was just lying in the bath going, and saying, but it was, even then I remember really insisting that the end of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest was a happy ending. But I don't understand this. It was a happy ending. It was just like, after a fashion, Rob, but come on. So, yes, I really had to learn. And since then, I've been terrible. Another way, I was at university and we watched Awakenings, and I was trying to be all cry in front of my new flatmates. Yeah. But I held on. I was like, I'm fine. And I went to go to my room, and my room was locked. I'd left the keys in the kitchen. And I just got to my room door and like was trying to open my own room at university and just in the corridor and the hall going, crying about Awakenings in the corridor. So I've caught up since. Okay. But yeah, the floodgates was One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Such a great psychopath test. Just to
I can't understand it because it's a happy ending, obviously. And E.T., I mean, you know.
You're insane.
I know what happened there.
E.T.
I'm better
is
now.
Not a remotely happy film. E.T.
And honestly,
is horrible.
I cry at anything. I'm more likely than not to cry at any given episode of The Simpsons.
Yeah.
Sets me off.
Yeah. Any Simpsons episode that's about Homer and Lisa, I'm gonna.
Oh. But I'm just thinking of the bit where Maggie thinks that the ice cream is Marge's hair. Oh.
What is the film that you love, but it's not critically acclaimed? Most people don't like it, but you don't care what they say because you.
Well, I really enjoy a film that's, and I think lots of people probably agree with this. I think I've only ever enjoyed Hudson Hawk. Yeah, that's
Why
a good
that
film.
Get hated?
It's a lot of fun. Hey, mister, are you going to die? But if I'm honest, this one's more culturally complicated and I have a real proper relationship with it. In summer 1983, during our two-week summer holiday in the rainy British countryside, we had the proper rainy day and went to the cinema. And I always dreamed of that day because then we'd go to the, you know, and see. And it would often be a James Bond movie. And in summer 83, I thought saw one of the, what at the time was the best film I'd ever seen. And I would still watch it any day. And that's Octopussy.
It's a lovely answer.
Yeah. And I have to say, obviously, it's fairly socially indefensible. Yeah. But I'm pretty right on. And I think that it is much more crass than properly offensive. Ill-judged. I mean, but don't get me wrong, I'm not going to stand up in court and defend it against charges of sexism and racism and stuff. But I still find it. And also, I wouldn't say I love a Roger Moore James Bond film because a lot of them are howling dogs. But I've got a real soft spot for Octopussy and it's exciting. The soundtrack is great and the action sequences are superb. He has that long chase where he has to get all the way across Germany and he's got like 4 hours. I love that. You don't see that. You know, well, someone's got loads of time and they can make phone calls and do hitchhiking and stuff. And yet in the end, he ends up with just 30 seconds to defuse the bomb. It's great. Great film. Love it. Indefensible.
Answer.
I'm ashamed that I said it.
Indefensible. I stand by it.
Can't bear it. I wouldn't wish it on a dog. I'm watching it tonight.
I'll take it to my grave. What is...
literally, apparently.
Yeah, maybe. What is the film that you used to love, but you've watched it recently and you do not like it anymore, for whatever reason that might be?
You know, it's funny, this one. The ones that really jump out, I remember really enjoying at the time. And I feel bad about this, but I just want to speak. I know, like, you know, this is an issue, isn't it? When you realise the stories of the films, what they mean, and people make films, you know what I mean? You don't want to hold anything against anyone. But having said that, I think there's a national treasure, a legend, a very talented guy who's making brilliant films, whose early films are quite hard to watch now. And I remember enjoying them a lot. And that's, I feel bad now, in case he's your best mate. Peter's Friends and what's the other one? Dead Again. Have you seen Dead Again?
Oh, Dead Again is amazing. Woo! Dead Again is wild.
And the funny thing is that it is a difference in perspective because at the time, maybe it was just my immaturity, but I just thought, this is great. Yeah, this plays like a hitchhot. Yeah. Like I'd seen Vertigo and then I watched Dead Again and thought, yeah, that was good. It doesn't feel like that when you watch it now.
How does it feel? I've not watched it. I used to fucking love Dead Again.
Yeah, well, it is clunky. And after a while, you just don't buy into it. You think these British guys are just doing American accents and there's like a cartoon. They're just kind of... And in a way, Peter's Friends is like that too. You see The Big Chill and then you see Peter's Friends and I don't know, they just don't feel, I can't buy into them anymore. They feel like drama exercises, you know?
Thank you for checking if Kenneth Branagh is my best friend.
Well, I shook his hand once. I think, I mean, obviously he's great. And he's all over, I love his work. I love his Shakespeare. His Shakespeare films from the time date amazingly. I think Much Ado About Nothing is underrated from here. I think it's fantastic. And the Hamlet, that whole Hamlet is fantastic.
Yeah, it's really good.
But having said that, my Miss Marple, I went for Miss Marple over Poirot. Anyway, so that would definitely be it, although I feel bad about it. I think there's a couple of films that I really loved that are probably appalling, but I'll avoid them. Those kind of 80s musicals, and they'd be really rubbish and probably like all kinds of offensive as well. Films like Electric Dreams.
Oh, okay.
And what's the other? Xanadu. I thought Xanadu was great.
Right.
I have seen Xanadu. It's terrible. It doesn't even hang together. It doesn't make any sense. And I thought it was great. It's amazing how open-minded we were. The stuff we just go, oh, okay. Yeah, that's a film. Yeah, I'm entertained. I know what's going on. And like, incomprehensible rubbish. So, yeah, Xanadu and Electric. In fact, I'm sorry, Sir Kenneth. All wrong. Xanadu. He's in Oscar nominated this year. Of course, full respect. Xanadu, Electric Dreams. I haven't seen Electric Dreams again, so we go Xanadu. That is a film which I have to admit that I loved. I don't know why. Probably pre-ET, full psychopath. And I've seen it since. And it's one of the worst things that's ever been through my eye.
Really good answer. I like the journey to get there.
I don't think I'm ever going to work with Sir Ken now.
I think he'll forgive you because he seems like a very magnanimous.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch, subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Hacks is back for season 3, and so is the official Hacks podcast. In each episode, Hacks creators Lucia Aniello, Paul W. Downs, and Jen Statsky speak with cast and crew members to unpack the Emmy-winning comedy series. You'll hear Hannah Einbinder and Jean Smart speak to their on-screen dynamic, along with Hacks writer and actor Pat Regan, on how their improv experience helped them when shooting scenes and what it was like writing scripts for specific actors.
You'll also hear from crew members like the costume designers on what it was like creating the world that Deborah and Ava inhabit. Hear stories from the show's writer's room, on-set antics, and more. Watch Hacks streaming exclusively on Max, and listen to the official Hacks podcast on Max or wherever you get your podcasts.
Man. What is the film that means the most to you? Not necessarily the film itself is any good, but because the experience you had around seeing it that will always make it special to you, Mr. Rob Deering.
Well, I'm slightly embarrassed about this film because the answer ultimately comes to me really obviously, and it's definitely a film, but I'm a bit embarrassed because it's so kind of on the nose. But I think that when it comes down to it, these are the films I love. You know, I love films, entertaining films that work. Is where I live, you know? So I've got to learn to lose my shame of Hollywood doing what it does best. Anyway, Ferris Bueller changed my life. Just changed my life. I was on, I'd seen a poster for it at the cinema. I'd have been, what are we talking, 87? So I'm 14, 15. And I saw the poster, you know, the kind of screen print poster of the car going the opposite direction in the traffic.
Right.
And it's called Ferris Bueller's Day Off. And I immediately thought, oh, that sounds great. I love the sound of this film.
I love a day off.
I mean, I'm so lazy and I'm a psychopath. I mean, when you think back to that, I mean, why did I light on that thinking that looks good? But it was something a bit different, wasn't it? And then I went on a school trip to America. I mean, you don't get those anymore, do you? Isn't that fantastic? We went, it was an arts exchange. So it was absolutely, you know, there was a proper Dead Poets, I was going to say, like Dead Poets Society, only not sad. But let's say, well, what was sad about Dead Poets Society, really? I mean, you know, the children get educated. I was emotionally awake by the time I saw that film. So I was on this arts exchange to America. So I was doing all real, you know, actual, I was in a play we loved doing. We went to see... we went to all kind of music things, but also I was hanging around with these cool Americans and properly, I said, that's when I kind of decided to start wearing black clothes and listening to The Cure all day long and everything.
Right.
And it was just, I was really, it was a real teenage moment where I was finding out who I was. And that was already happening.
What was the play you were in?
Oh, What Lovely War.
Great.
Yeah. And it was good. You know, it's a good play, right? And it's basically a very workshop script. So if you do it right, you're doing it like they did in Theatre Royal Strathclyde. And we did it in this big theatre in Marblehead, north of Boston. And everyone went, good job. And I didn't know what that phrase meant. I was like, what does that mean? Good job. And then... And I spent all my money on a Mickey Mouse baseball jacket and literally decided the next day to wear black for the rest of my life. So, you know, it's a moment in time. Anyway, my friend's exchange, not mine. Mine was the crazy man. I said, what's my exchange like? And they said, he spent a year thinking he was a bird. But my friend was up the road staying with this girl who was lovely. And we went to his exchange house. And watched a video, and it was and again shows the timing, because it was Ferris Bueller's Day Off released on VHS before it had even been on at the cinema in the UK.
So
just watched it on VHS in this living room, but in America, and it's Ferris Bueller's Day Off, and honestly, life moves pretty fast, and if you don't stop and look around once in a while, you could miss it. I honestly, you know, WWFD written on my underpants. And I know that from here, I was just the other day, someone was saying, oh, he's such an arrogant little privileged scroat, you know. But I think John Hughes knew that. You know, when Ferris Bueller complains about not having a car, you're not supposed to sympathize with him. Yeah. You know he's spoiled when he says that, you know. But anyway, it changed my life. It was a compass reading for what to do with yourself at an incredibly vulnerable moment when I was actually in America thinking, who could I be? What could I do as a teenager? And Ferris came along in what to me looked like a really cool cardigan and made some decisions that I really respected. Yeah, and now it's only now that I like watching Back to the Future and stuff. It's just amazing how these apparently rebellious teens still basically get married at the end. They don't get a girlfriend at the end. They get married at the end.
Yeah,
Marty McFly and Ferris Bueller and these women who are just a function of them decide to get married. It was the 50s, not the 80s, it turns out. But anyway, Ferris Bueller's Day Off changed my life.
It's very much a cultural... You know, I'm obsessed, I'm obsessed with a show called The Bachelor in America. I don't know if you've heard of it.
But I've heard of it.
It's such a fascinating sort of cultural thing, because it's a show in which the bachelor, a man, is encouraged to date and I think sleep with 25 women over the course of a few months. But at the end of it, he has to marry one of them. It ends in marriage. So there's this weird sort of puritanical, weirdly like... go and have some fun, but at the end of this, you're getting married, son. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. And I mean, how old are these bachelors?
In their 20s?
Too young. You know, just have a good...
I'm also like, at the end, just go like, do you want to go on another date? You don't have to marry them. Jesus.
No, exactly. I mean, I love my wife, and we got together, and we liked each other immediately. You know, it's been a lovely textbook relationship. Lucky me. I don't know, you know, I really lucked out. But still, when we first met, we kind of got together and then we didn't see each other for 2 months. And it was a shame. We really missed each other. We exchanged postcards and stuff. It was still very healthy. And then, you know, and then we got out, you know, and then we didn't get married when I got back. You know, it's just life takes longer than that. You know, life, I suppose life moves pretty fast.
Yeah. And by the way, it works both ways. Just so you know, it's the Bachelorette happens after the Bachelor, and the Bachelorette dates 25 men, and then in the end, she has to marry one of them.
The thing is that it basically works on the assumption that, first of all, that you know everyone's straight, and secondly, that you are everyone from the opposite gender is just a possibility to be a life mate. And that's just no way to approach other humans, is it? It's just no way to go into it.
No. Shame.
Sorted that out. But it is, you know, I think that Back to the Future is like, you know, it's near perfect, isn't it? It's such a great film. It's I didn't realise until recent years that they would have been just as worried about it feeling queasy if they did it wrong. I just thought they were blasé about it, but it's so well judged with him, with the thing with his mum and everything. It could be awful. If that was a bad film, you'd go, oh, this is awful. And as it is, it just works. And Michael J. Fox is perfect. And the whole, you know, they worked really hard to make a perfect film. The fact that the Steven Spielberg thing where he said start it really slow for ages to make it exciting. Is that true? I heard that. They say, it was Steven Spielberg's advice. The reason you spend ages looking at... Doc Brown's alarm clock and he has an audition for the band thing is so that the rest of the film seems so exciting because you just really take your time for the first 15 minutes. Mm. And that was a Steven Spielberg. Anyway, so I hear. But the thing that is that he basically has this girl who says, I love you. Then she isn't in the film. And then at the end, they get together, and particularly with the sequels and everything. That's it. They start the clan of people who look exactly like him. I mean, it's all, you know, it's more Deliverance than Back to the Future, really, isn't it?
What is the film you most relate to, Rob Deering?
Obviously, Ferris Bueller still. No, that's changed a lot, but it was a moment in time. I have to say, I'm kind of reverse engineering this because I'm not sure I particularly watch films in that way. You know what I mean? I'm a little bit ashamed because I still really love the kind of James Bond model guy with, I suppose, really, no, it's modulated. I like the Matt Damon model, you know, the guy who is just whatever he does, he's an absolute expert at it, but he's very diffident about that. And then he's a hero who survives, you know, whether it's being on Mars or playing poker or being an international assassin, but with guilt, you know, this is so, but you can't identify with those guys because they're at best, it's male fantasy. And at worst, I'm a psychopath again. So, but that's what I love. I love a Jason Bourne. I love an Ethan Hunt, you know.
Right.
And I suppose where I relate to them and where they've actually influenced my life is the running. Like, talking about running, you know, when I go for a run, I'm not trying to be Mo Farah. You know, I don't read the magazines. I don't know what people who run are doing. And I don't want to see myself running because I run like a big rolling, I run like a fat bloke and always will. And, but I'm Jason Bourne on the beach in Goa. That's who's running when I go for a run. And that thing that people always take the mickey out of that Tom Cruise runs in all his films.
Yeah.
Oh, God, I love those scenes. Mission Impossible 3. Just turn left and run three quarters of a mile down there. Oh, my God. And then they just do it again on top of Blackfriars Bridge in Mission Impossible Fallout. Honestly, I'm literally trying to find a ladder on Blackfriars Station so that I can get a fast run across the top of Blackfriars Bridge because I love that thing. So, yeah, films where Tom Cruise runs.
I love it. What an excellent answer. Rob Deering, look me in the eye. What's the sexiest film you've ever seen? Look away.
Sexiest? Whoa. Well, I've got to tell you.
Go on.
I need a minute. That's the sexiest one I've ever seen. Okay, full disclosure. I'm talking about things being crass and quite on the nose. I didn't know what I was getting into when I sat down to watch Bound.
Nice.
And that was a...
Nice.
That, nice. That's nice. Right. Whee!
That's a lovely film. No, that's a very good film.
Yeah, I mean, obviously it seems, you know, it's just basically, in any other circumstance, it's just me saying, hey, so I was watching some pretty on-the-nose soft porn. But the thing is, I was expecting a good, tight little thriller.
Yeah.
And so when, is it Jennifer Tilly and Gina Gershon?
It is.
When they got together, which is a sexy scene.
Yes.
Oh, I didn't know what I was going to do with myself. So, yeah, probably that.
Okay. Great answer. What? There's a subcategory.
An honest answer. It's not a great answer, is it? I mean, I don't come off particularly well.
Listen, all I care about is people being honest in this question. It really
Truth
annoys me.
Truth is best.
It really annoys me when people go like, oh, the romance of a screwball comedy. I'm like, shut up. You liar. What's the... There's a subcategory. Troubling boners, worrying wide-ons. A film you found arousing that you weren't sure that you should. Rob Deering.
Well, yeah, this is really interesting in terms of what you just said, because sometimes you think, oh, I really shouldn't fancy that person or find this thing sexy, but I do. But I think in the history of cinema, again, you realise looking back that people meant that, you know?
Yeah.
So, for example, I really fancy, what's her name, Joan Greenwood in the Ealing comedies? That's nice. Joan Greenwood, isn't it? With the posh, sexy voice.
Posh Joan Greenwood?
Yeah, yeah.
Impossible to say.
Yeah, posh sexy. It's a bit greaves on the lovely sexy Kim. Yeah, posh voice sexy Joan Greenwood. But the thing is, at first I was like, oh, you're not supposed to fancy her. She's all posh and in the old days or whatever. But like, you know, those ceiling guys knew what they were doing. They were trying to work around the Hays Code and sell those films in America. She's supposed to be sexy. So there's no shame in that. I had an experience I want to tell you about where I felt guilty. But again, the film was sexy, so it doesn't really count. But do you remember Sliver with Sharon Stone?
Huge fan.
Great.
Huge fan.
Yeah, it's all, you know, hidden cameras and people, you know, masturbating in hotel rooms, and, you know, it's grubby, isn't it? It's grubby and great film. Well, I saw that on a boat. I used to tour around a lot, going off to Europe on ferries. And on the longer trips, you'd be able to go to the cinema. And I thought, this is brilliant, you know. And I'd watch any. I saw Spice World on a boat, for goodness sake. What was my life? But anyway, I went to see. And sometimes the cinema on a boat would be a little cinema. And sometimes it would be a more multi-purpose room with a screen drop down. Mm. Anyway, I went to see Sliver in what was this voyeurism thriller in what was essentially like a conference room. And there was no one there. I found it. I had a ticket, but no one showed me in or anything. I just saw, W4 or whatever. Went through this boat door, sat at a comfy chair next to a table. I was smoked then. So there's an ashtray, lit a cigarette. And then they started this film about watching people. And there's no other people around. And I just, there's nothing to do with the embarrassment of the film. You're supposed to find that film sexy. Yeah. But I felt like a ridiculous character. I felt like I was, I felt like the watcher. I was Mr. Grubby Producer. You know, I felt like I was going to scratch my, shoot again, wind that scene back. And it was such a weird experience. But it was like, I'll tell you what it was like. It was like secret cinema. It was like my own little secret cinema voyeuristic experience. But neither of those answer your question. And I'm going to get to cut to the chase now. You know, we were talking about Sinbad and the Eye of the Tiger.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember it? Have you seen it?
Is it the one with Medusa? Is your answer going to be Medusa?
No, that's Clash of the Titans. That's good stuff. No, in Sinbad and the Eye of the Tiger, the baddie is a witch. I think she's quite gorgeous and sexy. I don't remember. And I'm really embarrassed. I'm going to finish the story now and you can have it. I think towards the end of the film, she disguises herself as a seagull with a potion. And she's got the potion that can change her back. And she just makes it back and has the potion, but there isn't really enough, and she's left with one seagull leg. I thought that was pretty sexy at the time. Who am I? What was going on when I was little?
You were
unbelievable,
frightening child.
I don't know. Maybe someone's going to sit down. I mean, an imaginary person is going to sit down and watch Sinbad and the Eye of the Tiger and see that last scene of this witch going, "Oh no, my one seagull leg," and go, "Oh yeah, no, I get it."
It sounds sexy when you describe it.
I mean, who wouldn't, you know, want one seagull leg in very poor special effects?
Seagull leg.
she really cannot resist chips after that, particularly eating outside.
Also, the one seagull leg. So does that mean she's very, is it a very long leg?
Oh, no, it's human-sized seagull
leg. A human-sized seagull leg.
I mean, and also in terms of special effects, I think it covers up her actual legs. So it's more like an elephant's foot. Yeah.
What's objectively the greatest film of all time?
Yeah, okay, so just on the list, not from me. I have to say, I really don't think you can say this, can you? I mean, you could pick a film for all time, but only subjectively, because you've got to be in the mood for it, you know what I mean? You could say, okay, it's The Searchers, and then, you know, you could argue that point, or Citizen Kane. But I think in real terms, in real life, if a film hits all the dots, if a film is within its own compass, perfect, like a jewel, you know, when you see a film and you think that's really good, and then it starts to become multidimensional. Like, so you see that, I don't know, the script supports the story, the casting, the music is perfect. The storytelling is helped by the music and the casting. The storytelling builds up to the surprises. And every time you look at it, every time you watch it again, you find a new detail which supports your very first idea of how good it is. That's 100%, isn't it? That's five stars. Yeah. Those are the best films. And there's loads of them, you know? I think that, I don't know, I think Frozen is a perfect film.
It really is.
You know, and I've got School of Rock. School of Rock is...
Yes, correct.
The Matrix. They all, in terms of succeeding in what they set out to do, Good Will Hunting, they just bang, right on the money. So I think, you know, my true answer would be there's loads. But I think really maybe, and it's also to do with what I was saying about popular films, you know, it's very easy to say, oh, I love this piece of art. You know, a couple of years after Ferris Bueller's Day Off, if you'd asked me this, I'd have said Wings of Desire. No two ways about it. That's fantastic. Wings of Desire. I stand by it. It's a great film. I loved it. But it is just a specific film for a moment in time. And it's not better because it's art house or black and white. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So I think when films really say something and are really entertaining, and specifically, you could walk in and say, well, that was a really cracking yarn, or that really changed how I feel about the whole subject. You know, like a good poem. But yeah. Those are probably the best. Like Get Out or bloody Parasite.
Yeah.
You know, it either works as a kind of treatise on modern society or just a cracking story. And I watched one the other day, which I think I did see once years ago, but I saw it again, and it fits that description of being perfect and small and everything supports everything. And it's an entertainment, but it's also truly a piece of art that sort of has echoes throughout. It's The Conversation. Let's go with The Conversation.
Great, great film. Great answer.
I mean, when you think about the everything, how everything supports everything, the music that David Shire does is so odd and intellectual, and yet it's also a great theme tune. It's melodic. You can hook into it. It's a fantastic film.
It's really good, that film. Good answer. What is the film that you could or have watched the most over and over again?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny, isn't it? I think it's really important your past tense have watched over and over again. It really counts, doesn't it? Because you don't plan it, you know? Like, I would think it would be, I'm sure this is everyone's, it's an obvious one, and I love it, it's Midnight Run. But I don't actually watch Midnight Run that often. I think it's too important to me. Whereas a film like The Fugitive, if it's on telly, I'll watch it. I'll watch it to the end. So I think the one that kind of sums it, I'd just like Men Running. You know, let's see it. But Harrison Ford's a flappy runner. He's a bad runner. I remember Joe Heenan pointing out. That's like, Joe Heenan loves a clumsy hero. So Indiana Jones in that first scene, he's all dusty. So he's going to fall over. And like Robert Redford's clumsy, isn't he? Anyway, what did I say? I didn't say the one that I always watch, but I do really love, but it's a sort of classic, sort of generic. It's In the Line of Fire.
Ah, what a great film.
I'm always going back to In the Line of Fire. I think it's just exactly that, isn't it? It's like a good, old-fashioned,
it's really
well-done,
good.
Generic thriller. And I think there's something, I think Clint Eastwood in it has got a, elevates it with the, I mean, he's miscast in it, really. He's older than the character should be. But it's so lovely to see Clint Eastwood give such good vulnerable, doesn't he? He plays old really well, really. There's no modesty to it. And the other thing he does in The Line of Fire, which is really weird how much I love it, but it's one of the best colds. And he gets a cold. He's got a cold on the plane and says, it's astonishing. I love In the Line of Fire. It's definitely In the Line of Fire.
Great, 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 great film.
Although I should say on behalf of my children, but she's so much younger than him. Come on. that is true. But if it's going to be anyone, it should be Reni Russo. She's perfect in that role.
She is.
She plays that role a lot, the kind of within sexist Hollywood, giving the agency to the slightly older, you know, get Shorty in the Line of Fire, Thomas Crown Affair. You can't really. Lethal Weapon 3 is great. I always liked it more than the first two.
Yeah. We don't like to be negative. What's the worst film you ever saw?
Well, I like to be negative. No, it's interesting, isn't it? Because I think when you get down there, I don't really like to be negative. I don't know why I said that. It was just being contrary, which is the same thing, isn't it? Please cut that. Please cut that bit. I'm joking.
I don't want them to see the real me.
I've learned to cry. I won't kill again.
Come back, E.T. I do miss you.
I couldn't watch it now. I wouldn't sit down to E.T. now because it would ruin my day. And one of these days I'll get back to it. It's too hard.
Never. No way. I will never watch that film again.
Do you find getting older that you avoid films that are going to make you cry?
I've avoided E.T. since I was six. I'm no fool.
Yeah, if you're emotionally literate at the time, I'm talking about the scarringness of melting faces and burnt setting things on fire. But what about the scarringness of a broken heart? Yeah, it's lucky. Yeah. It's lucky my hard carapace of emotionlessness was in place. Now, that's not
Google's
what you're
carapace.
Asking. Oh yeah, there's specifically two different kinds of terrible films, aren't there? There's terrible films that are just completely flat. They just don't engage. Don't care. You know, the script's rubbish, nothing rings true. They're just flat, they're just inert. And then there's terrible films where you don't know what's going on. Yeah. What were they thinking? What's even happening now? And what's weird is that the second kind, they're probably worse, but they're also much more entertaining. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because, you know, something like, I don't know, Battlefield Earth. It's a shocking film, but it's eminently watchable. It's all over the place.
Yeah.
Whereas there's sort of various sort of like sequels and things that you just think, ugh. So I think one of the worst films I ever saw in the cinema was the Avengers, the British TV series Avengers.
Okay.
I don't know what was happening in that film. I mean, it just didn't hang together.
Ray Fiennes, Uma Thurman,
Sean Connery, Eddie Izzard. It looked like it was going to be good. It was incomprehensible. And loads of people not talking. You know, people worry about a script. They just cut the script. It's like Moonraker, just screeds and screeds of screen time with nobody talking and not much happening at all. But anyway, no. The worst film in the history of cinema is Michael Winner's Bullseye with Roger Moore. Michael Caine, which is fabulously entertaining. But my God, it's bad. And it's because it's bad anyway, because it's got this kind of gleeful, they made it because they're mates and they're both playing dual roles. So you get Roger Moore and Michael Caine doing accents. Michael Caine in full bad Michael Caine rather than good Michael Caine mode. Roger Moore. I mean, it's fun, but it's so bad, like technically bad. There's a bit where a guy goes and knocks on the door in a train, and then the person who answers the door shoots him, I think. It's a long time. Watched it again. Yeah. And somehow the special effect, I think they did it with a mannequin or something, but the guy kind of shatters, you know, it's like bits of it's a similar effect, but without deliberately being a joke, as when the guy in Top Secret falls off the tower, Nazi goes, aye! And there's like Wilhelm Scream falls off the tower. And then when he hits the ground at the bottom, he smashes like a vase. So Michael Winner does that, but without any comic intent. And my friend Ferg was watching this, and I was sitting next to him, and he said to me, that's the worst thing I've ever seen. And you know, I could stand by that. It was the worst thing I've ever seen. There's a bit at the end where they're, oh, and the other thing is that Michael Caine being an expert at darts is a key thing. Him being able to throw darts. Oh God. And there's a bit at the end where they jump over a building on a motorbike, which is terrible anyway. But then I remember the scene. It's so obviously an assistant just pushing a motorbike front wheel into shot. You know what I mean? And oh, it's brilliantly bad. I don't think you hear enough about how bad Bullseye is, and it's worth a watch.
All right, you've probably sold that. What? You're in comedy. You're a comedian. You're very funny.
Thank you.
What's the film that made you laugh the most?
Ooh, yeah. I just mentioned Top Secret. That's got a lot of good jokes in it, isn't it? That's good. It's funny, isn't it? Because I think the ones where you laugh the most tend to be a little bit, you get slightly less narrative. Like, they need to really commit to the comedy. Yeah. You know, like, I know that on Shaun of the Dead, they really made a point of saying, if it's a choice between a laugh line and keeping the emotional curve of the film, we're going to do the latter so that you get a film. And that's absolutely inspired. They're exactly right, weren't they? And when you think about this, the ones that make you laugh the most are the ones that don't matter and it's just funny. You know, I mean, honestly, when Joe Pesci sets his own head on fire at the end of Home Alone, I don't think specifically at that moment, I don't think I've ever laughed louder in the cinema. Yeah. When it just goes, and they just hold on it for ages. Oh, God, I laugh. So I think a film that made me laugh all the way through, even though it was decidedly patchy, but when it made me laugh, I people around me were looking at me in the cinema thinking, what's he going to do? Because I laugh loud anyway. I laugh like my dad. That's my joke. And when it's really funny, I kind of flail around. People do, don't they? Sort of fall off your chair and stuff. I think it's Wayne's World 2. Wayne's World 2, when he has the fight with Cassandra's dad. Honestly, I didn't know what I was going to do with myself. I laughed as much as when I saw Rick Mayall live. It was like, oh my word. And when is the scene going to end? You know, it just kept coming. And again, I don't even stand by it. It's doubtless pretty indefensible, but my memory of, and it isn't as good as a film. It's not as good as Wayne's World, but the funny bits in it, that scene. Oh, I laughed.
I like that answer a lot. Rob Deering, you have been an absolute delight. Very much as expected. I too have fantasized about this episode with you. And it has outlived my expectations. However, when you were hanging out in the small village where you used to be.
Yeah, have they found out who that was yet?
Well, they have. What happened was you were, where you lived, next to the baker and the doctor and the candlestick maker, and you've gone for a walk, and there appeared a little old lady called Miss Marple, and she said, hello, I'm just visiting. And you said, oh, it's lovely to see you. And she said, would you mind walking me through the woods? And you said, yeah, absolutely, of course I would. I love nature trails. I usually run, Miss Marple. And you took her arm, and you walked And as you headed towards some trees where no one could see you, she pulled a axe from her back pocket, a little mini axe, and she chopped you in the fucking head with it. And she repeatedly struck you in the head with her little axe until you were dead. And then,
what a cow!
Yeah, and then, no spoilers, but she then framed the candlestick maker for your murder, and that person is still languishing in jail. And she,
are you saying, do you think that she did all the murders in all the stories which she apparently
saw? It's not for me to say what other murders she may have done. I just know she did this one.
And an axe that small could be very convenient.
Now, I was walking through the woods in this little Sylvanian family town, and I see, and I'm like, what's all this up ahead? I'm walking along with a coffin, you know what I'm like. And I see animals tearing apart the corpse of someone. And I pull up, and I'm like, oh, that's Rob Deering, isn't it?
Look, when you say animals, were they wild animals, or were they hedgehogs were dressed as doctors?
There was the Dr. Badger, and the Baker Beaver, and the Candlestick Cat. And they
much in the manner of Zootropolis, their essential nature had been revealed, and they were tearing me to shreds. Oh, that's interesting.
They were eating you. I said, shoo, get out of it. And I did what I could. I got the bits of you that I could into the coffin, but there was shrubbery, wood, sticks, all sorts. Anyway, I stuff you in the coffin. It's absolutely jammed in there.
Like some kind of nightmare muesli.
And there's no room in this muesli. There's only enough room for me to slip one DVD into the side for you to take across to the other side. And on the other side, it's movie night every night. What film are you taking to show the people of heaven when it's your movie night, Mr. Rob Deering?
Yeah. This is really interesting, isn't it, in terms of what we said? Because you want to say, I'm going to take this film that I absolutely love. You know, I don't watch True Grit every day. I would cry so much every day. I don't want to watch Midnight Run every day. I would cry so much every day in the middle there, in that scene where, you know, the scene.
Sure.
So I think if I'm brutally honest, let's be completely honest about this. I don't think I could ever get sick of watching In the Line of Fire. So we stay with that. It's going to be
what
In the Line of Fire.
Wonderful answer.
And if I can make an emotional claim, I think that I really relate to Clint Eastwood in these films with his vulnerability, because he does remind me emotionally of my late wonderful dad, who was absolutely fantastic and the best dad, but also in the manner of someone born in 1942, not given to bold, wild displays of emotion or hugs. And so what I'm saying is that what seems like a fairly crass answer does actually have some emotional depth.
I'm not a psychopath. That's all I need to tell you.
Mother, blood. I'm taking In the Line of Fire, and I'm not ashamed.
Rob Deering, is there anything you would like to tell people to look out for or to listen to or to read in the coming times?
Well, if you are basically the stuff that you should look out for relating to me is currently all running related. So check that out. I did, and it's all, I've got two podcasts, Running Commentary, where me and Paul Tonkinson talk about life and running while we run. You got the Running Tracks Radio Hour, where I do the playlist. You don't have to run. You could just listen to the songs. They're great, but you will have to listen to me running, telling you about them. And then there's the book of that, which is nice. Again, if you want to, you know, dig a bit deeper into the emotion of the thing, but it's funny. My book, Running Tracks, the playlist and places that made me a runner, is available. It's gorgeous. It's got, can I show you a picture? Wait there. You got to see this. Damn it. It's relevant. I should have had one handy.
For the listener, he's running to the back of the room. And now he's running back, showing us the running. Have you been standing this whole time?
Yeah, that's where the computer is.
Love it.
Look, this, you can see why I got this. Oh, Saul Bass-inspired cover. Look at that. Isn't that gorgeous?
That is genuinely very cool.
It's by me, Cobb, but it was my idea. And it looks like, for those of you listening, it's called Running Tracks, but it looks like what we're talking about, Anatomy of a Murder, Vertigo.
Yeah, Anatomy of a Murder of a Man Running on the Grooves of a Record.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's you did. Great. You imagine a murder with an axe from a sweet little old lady. Thanks very much. But, and 50% of the profits of that go to Parkinson's UK.
Very nice.
I'm thinking I am going to start a movie podcast because I feel like, you know,
There's a gap in the market.
Yeah. But that's going to be called the X to Z of the movies, and it's not going to be as good as this one. But look out for it. Enjoy it.
Rob Deering, God bless you. Thank you for your time. Have a lovely death.
Thanks for having me. Sorry I had to die for that to take place.
Real shame. Lots of love. Good day to you. Goodbye.
So that was episode 196. Head over to patreon.com/Brett Goldstein for the extra 20 minutes of chat, secrets and video with Rob. Go to Apple Podcasts, give us a 5-star rating, but write about the film that means the most to you and why. I'll tell you why you should do that, because my neighbour Maureen loves reading it, always makes her cry. Thank you so much to Rob for doing the show. Thank you to Scroobius Pip and the Distraction Pieces Network. Thanks to Buddy Peace for producing it. Thanks to Acast for hosting it. Thanks to Adam Richardson for the graphics and Lisa Lydon for the photography. Come and join me next week for another brilliant guest. I hope you're all well. Thank you very much for listening. That is it for now. In the meantime, have a lovely week and please be excellent to each other.
Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune in to what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, which is different than empathy, right?
Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.